thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon for the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans-sponsored teleconference, Overcoming Outreach and Employment Placement Barriers for Women Veterans. My name is Bailey Crone, and I'm the Director of Technical Assistance at NCHV. Many of you have participated in my previous teleconferences, so particularly those pertaining to HVRP that have occurred over the past few weeks. Thank you, everyone, for your insightful and respectful feedback on the calls, as well as for today's call. Today's call will have a slightly modified format. We've arranged for two knowledgeable and experienced guest speakers who are going to discuss new research and innovative program strategies targeting needs and barriers to employment of homeless women veterans. Our first speaker is Risa Greenlinger from the she's the Director of Veterans Programs at the National Center on Family Homelessness. And our second speaker is Kathy Mackey. She's part of the Goodwill Industry of Houston's Homeless Female Veteran and Veterans with Families HVRP program. Between the presentations, we'll have a short Q&A and comments section, and then we'll have additional time for questions and comments at the end of the call. If we don't get to your questions or your comments during today's call, or if you think of information you'd like to share after the call today, you can go ahead and email that to me or give me a call, and I can share that with today's speakers as well. Again, my name is Bailey Crone, and my email address is bcrone@nchv.org, and I can get that at the end of the conference today as well. We're going to go ahead and get started with Risa's presentation. To access that on the website, I ask that everyone please go to www.nchv.org. Again, that's www.nchv.org. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a gray box with a red outline. Click on that. It says NCHV Conference Calls. The very first one you see there is today's call, our teleconference for homeless women veteran service providers. If you scroll down, you'll see a couple of links. It says presentation and then four handouts. Please click on the link that says presentation, and it'll bring you up to a PDF of Risa's presentation. And I will go over this again at the end of Risa's presentation, just so everyone can have access to that if they got on the call late. Risa, whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you so much, Bailey, and it's such a pleasure to be with all of you today. I know how hard it is to engage women veterans, particularly those who are experiencing homelessness, because they are a difficult population to reach, and many women veterans are choosing not to self-identify. So I hope that in today's presentation you can learn about some of our research strategies and a specific project that we're doing in the Chicagoland area. But I want to really extrapolate out for you some techniques and practices that we've learned through a variety of work with homeless women veterans that have proven effective for not only finding women veterans, but really engaging them in whatever your project is. And obviously, job placement and job training is very critical. So I'm going to walk you through some of our research strategies. The genesis of this research is really focusing on a conundrum. Why is it that women veterans who on average have higher levels of education than male veterans and than many women civilians, how come in Chicago and nationwide the women veterans are lagging their male and female civilian counterparts in terms of their employment rates as well as wage attainment? Now, we all know that there's a gap between men and women and wages in the civilian world. So that isn't surprising. But the fact that that women veterans often have better education, you would think that that would help offset the gap, and it doesn't. And these gaps are most pronounced for the women veterans in the youngest age cohort, which is 18 to 24. It's also true that male veterans in that same young age cohort trail their male civilian counterparts. But for the women, it's a more exaggerated and more pronounced trend. And we're going to talk about in the research of why did we decide to do this study, we also looked at the fact that women veterans use fewer government benefits. So that really is across the board in terms of federal benefits. They don't use the VA as much. They don't use state or municipal or county resources as much as their male veteran counterparts. They're also less likely to self-identify. And 11% of, well, let me actually pause for a minute on why are they less likely to self-identify. Some of it reflects sort of a societal, you know, instinctive reaction. Larkin Ray Harris, who's the Navy veteran running our Chicago project, told the story just an hour ago to a group of workers from the Veterans Benefits Homeless Veterans Benefit Assistance Division of the VA. And in the story, she told about being approached by a male friend who is a veteran, and he had tickets to a Cubs game that were given in support of veterans, and they were told to invite their girlfriends and their wives. No recognition of the fact that Larkin is also a veteran and that you should be saying, you know, you can invite your spouses, your husbands, your wives, your girlfriends, your boyfriends. You know, another story that I heard when I was in California doing a listening tour with women veterans was a woman vet who's very proud of her military service, and she's so proud of it that she's got tattoos on her body, and her car is covered with all kinds of military-affiliated bumper stickers. And she was at the grocery store loading her vehicle with her groceries, and a male acquaintance approached her as she was finishing the loading and was just casually talking to her about the weather, whatever, and she finished loading up her car and put down the trunk, and then he could see all of her bumper stickers. And his first response was, "Oh, I didn't know your husband was a veteran." And she said, "No, I'm the veteran." Those kinds of stories are all too common, even though our language has changed and now we do talk about our men and women in uniform. But still, we somehow don't think of women as veterans. But it's also true that many women have been in support positions or may not have been deployed overseas, and they, if they haven't seen combat, they might not think of themselves as veterans. It's also true that a lot of women veterans have experienced trauma related to deployment, stress, combat experience, or even, in its worst case, military sexual trauma. And therefore, they may not be proudly associated like the woman with the trunk full, the bumper sticker full of military bumpers, of military slogans. So there may be other reasons for not wanting to self-identify. Of the single parents, 11% in the military are female as compared to 3% who are male. So we can extrapolate to the veteran population that more women than men are likely to be single parents. There are more support needs for women veterans, perhaps, to overcome barriers to employment, such as childcare, after-school care, or transportation. Greater stigma regarding their military service or lack of recognition to their service. Larkin Ray Harris also talks about this from her perspective of, you know, women don't get the same patriotic bump that men get for why they might wish to engage, to enlist in the military, because it's not a feminine choice of occupation. Your hair gets cut off. You're not encouraged to wear makeup. You should not have your nails done while you're in uniform. You encourage, if you're being deployed overseas, you're often encouraged to, you know, not have your comrades in arms see you as a woman. And so when people ask why you're joining the military, you actually women get asked more commonly why they joined the military, whereas for men it's more likely to be assumed that they saw it as their patriotic duty, or maybe they had a military affiliation in their family, or that it makes sense that the military is a legitimate career path. But it's still not seen as a legitimate career path for women, or a lot of people don't get why a woman might want to join the military. The last point on this slide of, you know, why the type of military assignments being, again, non-traditional work assignments for women, transportation, vehicle, aircraft maintenance, those non-traditional careers for women may be even harder to map to civilian employment. I think it's fair to say that all veterans, male or female, do talk about difficulties in translating what they did in the military to the civilian sector. The point here is that for women, because they've had non-traditional jobs, or that being in the military period is non-traditional, it can be even more difficult to explain. And certainly higher rates of military sexual trauma or trauma experience prior to military service for women causes comorbidities that negatively impact their job readiness. Well, what is a comorbidity? You know, it's such a clinical term. It really does refer to depression, PTSD, physical impacts of having had traumatic experiences, heart problems, self-medication, more issues with sleep deprivation. That's what we mean by comorbidities. So demographic trends add urgency to this need to address how do you reach women veterans and make sure that they're really engaging in services and that we do a better job of tying them to the employment, to the labor force. According to the Department of VA, it's estimated that women veterans are going to grow from almost 8% today to almost 15% in 2036. Because women veterans are more likely to be younger, the median age for women veterans is 47 versus 61 for men, that also indicates that that's sort of what's powering the rise for numbers of women veterans. Right now, women represent 20% of the recruits into the active duty forces, and those amounts may not jump as significantly, but because women veterans are younger, that means that, you know, male veterans will, they presumably live longer, and male veterans will be more represented in those who, you know, who will die sooner than the women. So you're likely to see and have more acute needs for women veterans. Women also don't tend to serve in the military as long as men. There are fewer women making careers in the military. The military's retention of women is not as strong as they would like it to be. So that also impacts the number of women veterans and accounts at least in part for their young ages. Women veterans are also more likely to identify as a racial minority, and from decades of research into chronic homelessness, we do know that there is a disproportionate representation of minorities among homeless veteran population, and that may prove to be true of women veterans as well as male veterans. And women veterans are four times more likely to be homeless than non-veteran women, according to a 2010 study where a man named Foster was the primary investigator. Women veterans currently comprise about 55% of the nation's homelessness population, but 23% of these homeless women veterans have children under the age of 18. And that came from 2010 VA statistics as well as a 2009 study with Mulhall as the principal. So, you know, that's also another poignant reason for, you know, it's both we've been seeing the efficacy of a housing first approach, but it's also very true that getting people reattached to the employment, to the labor force, and having the means to be able to support the housing is also a key way of restabilizing people's lives, and especially true for these women veterans. And we also know that there are just fewer programs out there able to serve women veterans with children or male veterans with children, and that they're the most underserved portion of the homeless veteran population. There is a severe lack of shelters or programs that take women with children. And when we did research with the U.S. Department of Labor Women's Bureau in Region 9 in California, the majority of the women in our study were all parents, but they were very few of them were custodial parents, and very few of the women felt that they were able to find shelters or transitional housing that would accommodate children over the age of 9, particularly male children. So they often ended up losing custody, and it was a fear that all too often got realized, that they wouldn't be able to keep their children with them. So what factors contribute to experiences of homelessness? Well, certainly economic conditions, their ability to retrain or move to find work, particularly if they are trying to maintain a connection to children, whether they're custodial or non-custodial parents. Because women are more isolated and don't use the existing federal, state, municipal, county resources, they have fewer support systems, and challenges related to their mental health, perhaps tied to trauma experience, substance abuse, and housing and food insecurity all play a role. What are the goals of our study? Well, we really want to compare male and female veteran unemployment and underemployment. We want to have a better understanding of the dynamics of homelessness among the unemployed female veterans, but we also want to explore effective service interventions. And to that end, we have designed the study so that it is an institution review board approved study. So what that means is a local hospital here in Massachusetts, where I'm based, that has ties to Harvard University. It's actually a Harvard teaching affiliated hospital. They have an institution review board. They reviewed the design of our study, and they have approved it as an informed human consent qualitative research study. So what we're going to do is one-on-one interviews with women veterans, including a cohort of those women who will be women currently experiencing homelessness. And the women to be studied are either employed or seeking employment. So they have to have some sense that they are job ready or want to be job ready. We're also going to conduct focus groups with veterans, both male and female, who are employed or seeking employment. And to the point that I made off of the last slide, we really want to talk with both employers as well as community stakeholders. And because many of the times best sources of employment for all veterans, men and women, have been government, we will look at both public and private sector employers. And the community stakeholders, what do we mean by community stakeholders? Well, we mean anybody in the community who is providing services to women veterans. So certainly we will talk with HRVP employers, and we've already set up contact with grantees, HRVP grantees, the Chicagoland area. We want to talk with disability advocates. We want to talk with and include people providing transitional housing, substance abuse, mental health services, physical health services, anybody who is working with veterans directly, as well as those who might not realize that they are, like domestic violence shelters, as an example. And we will interview all of these focus groups with instruments that really aim at understanding people's individual situations, but also what systemically might be contributing to both the lack of employment, even part-time employment, and why the wage gap seems to be so persistent, and not just between male and female veterans, but once again, also between women veterans and their counterparts in the civilian world. So the title of this talk is really focused on the practical tips of how do you reach and find and engage these women veterans who might not wish to be engaged. And in the handout, three of the four handouts use a favorite technique, that's tear-off flyers. So the tear-off flyers all have Lark and Ray Harris, our project coordinators, phone and email. And the reason why we've learned in California doing another project that's aimed at preventing domestic violence between veterans and those that they are in a relationship with, we've really learned that tear-off flyers work because they allow some anonymity. It's easy to go up to a bulletin board and just tear that contact information off. You don't have to tear and copy anything down. They are better than the static posters. People are more likely to actually hold on to it, even if they're tucking it into something, a crevice of a pocketbook. We do find that people really do have a tendency to take action quicker with them. Even our electronic versions of the flyers, they all have a live link for the email and the website on those tear-offs. And we've also learned some lessons. When we're offering services, whether it's a cognitive behavioral therapy that gives 10 sessions worth of group counseling, in essence, or whether it's inviting somebody to come in and participate in a one-on-one interview or a focus group, when we're offering services like childcare or, free training or free counseling, we've actually learned not to say free, because so many people seem to think, or on-site childcare, people seem to think that if it's free, that it's suspicious or that it's too good to be true. So we've learned to say things like no cost to you, implying that there is a cost, but it's being borne by somebody else. It's amazing how suspicious folks are of saying that something is free. We do offer on-site childcare, and that often makes a huge difference for whether or not people will come. Because once again, even if somebody is non-custodial, they oftentimes do have contact with the child. You see it in stand-downs. I don't know how many of you have gone to stand-downs, and there are veterans there with children, but when you talk with them, the children are not living with them. The children are with another relative. But they took them with them because it's sort of, an activity or something, maybe even a little fun or something that they could do together. And veterans, are often really fighting who are homeless. They're often really fighting to maintain some connection to those that they care about. We have learned that you should always offer lists of resources, but not presume that somebody wants them. To ask would it be helpful and to have it at the ready, but to, definitely have it but not to force it on anyone. We do provide stipends, but we don't use that word because, once again, language counts, and a lot of people, frankly, don't know what a stipend is or it's too academic. So we're, in most situations, regardless of what type of program we're running, are offering transportation, are really offering anything that would reduce the barriers to their participation. So we're providing some funds for their transportation and for their time of being there. But because in this specific project and even the project that we're doing in California, it's all tied to research, we can't be coercive. So we have more limits on what we can do, perhaps. The Institutional Review Board strictly sets parameters for us to make sure that, I actually mistyped. I wrote cohesive, and I meant to say coercive. So the value of the stipends has to be limited. It can't be anything that would place undue influence on people's behavior. So it's really a nice recognition. They tend to be, you know, in the range of $10 to $20 per type of stipend, and sometimes it varies. Like if we're in a really rural community where, you know, drive distances are longer, the transportation stipend might be higher. For Chicago, where we can do bus or train passes, the individual stipend or, you know, bus pass, train pass, the value of it may be lower, but it's something that is valuable and that will help get them to participate. And you can have the choice of using cash or desired gift cards like the passes or sometimes, you know, food or retail outlets that might help, might feel valuable to the participants. Some other techniques and methods that we've really learned is, it's like, you know, in real estate, everybody says location, location, location. Well, you can't be all things to all people, so it really pays to have the relationships with other providers and to have a relationship with your referral sources. But that often means that you really can't presume and that you have to do things your referrer's way. So everything from, you know, really understanding if you're recruiting, say, through campuses or universities or, you know, vocational schools, that you really want to understand what their policies are for posting materials on community bulletin boards. If they require a stamp, say, that you get that stamp, that when it's about to expire, that you go back, that you really follow the protocol so that nobody takes offense. And there's nothing like shoe leather. You know, it's showing up at events, and it's also the value of walking in the door to places that on the surface might not seem like a place to go. So with women veterans, some things that we outline in our toolkit, Engaging Veterans and Families to Enhance Service Delivery, we've discovered that with women veterans, again, since oftentimes they may be parents but non-custodial or they may be struggling with children that they do have, that getting to know officials within the juvenile justice system can be very valuable. That parents are often there in juvenile justice systems or family courts dealing with a person in need of supervision or custody issues, that there may be problems with children acting out and getting into trouble with the law, and that that's where you can find women veterans, that you can also find women veterans by creating relationships with discharge hospital social workers, as well as at domestic violence shelters. Because, again, unfortunately, one of the primary causes of homelessness among women veterans is definitely trauma. So finding providers who are engaged with the most at-risk population at the point of contact in which they are really, you know, most in need is often a great way to use that shoe leather and create relationships. But also Head Start, providers of community-based women's health services are also good places to go. And of course, if you don't ask for referrals or you don't ask for connections or you don't ask for women veterans to come and participate, well, then nothing happens. But you do want to ensure that your ask is appropriate. And part of that is to, you know, ask your potential referral sources to educate you on what they need when they're making a referral. And certainly within bounds of confidentiality, it always helps to let referral sources know what happened when they made the referral. But again, there are, you know, certain structures and strictures depending on confidentiality situations. And for us, we definitely want to link people in, if we're doing research, into the interim and final outcome briefings, and we try to provide them in person and electronically as well, because not everybody can come to events, but they often do really want to know what's happening. We do like doing in-person events because not only do you get to share information, but we try to encourage, let's say, our community stakeholders or our employers that we've attracted to the focus groups. We want to create learning communities so that we can all share best practices. You're going to hear from Kathy in a moment talking about what she's doing in Houston. Well, you know, Texas is a unique environment, and we all work in communities that do have regional differences and where those regional differences count. But there's always something that we can learn from one another and a great value in that sharing process. Sometimes it's just a reaffirmation that what you're doing is a good thing to be doing. Oh, and I guess there's one tip that I meant to also talk about that I didn't, and that's really found in, again, our Engaging Veterans and Families to Enhance Service Delivery. What we really found from talking with the most at-risk women veterans was that many of them no longer had internet access, but they did have cell phones. So we really learned early on to ask the women veterans if they had a cell phone, if it had texting capability, and to give us permission to reach out to them by text. You know, you work so hard to make the contact, but then you want to make sure that the women veterans come back and participate in your program or that you don't lose contact with them. And we have found that texting seems to be the method of communication that gets the most immediate response. And while older women veterans may not text, it's actually surprising how many of them do, and particularly those with teenage children have become more adept at it. And most phone plans these days are covering some basic amount of text. So just asking up front has really demonstrated that if they've got it, it's one of the ways that they're most responsive to us, and it's one of our best ways of retaining the woman veteran that we've worked so hard to connect to. So I'm going to stop right there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions now, but certainly, as Bailey mentioned, if you're not ready to ask a question or you don't want to ask in a public setting, you can always email Bailey and she'll get a hold of me and I'll be able to respond back to you. But feel free to ask me questions now.
Yeah, thank you, Risa. That was very informative, a lot of great information there. And next up we're going to have Kathy. Actually, if it's okay with both Risa and Kathy, would it be all right for us to hold questions till the end? Just for time-wise, I want to make sure that that Kathy has enough time as well. Does that work okay for you too?
Yep.
Is that okay? Okay.
Yes.
Kathy, are you there as well?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Risa, thank you very much for that information. And if you have questions for Risa, hold on to them for now until after Kathy's had a chance to present too, and then we'll open up for Q&A and comments for both of our speakers today, and then more general comments and questions. Kathy Mackey joins us from Goodwill Industries of Houston. She works in their Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program for homeless female veterans and veterans with families. So we'll go ahead and turn it over to Kathy.
Okay. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kathy Mackey, and I am an employment specialist with Goodwill Industries of Houston. I will be discussing various outreach strategies to facilitate a strong employment outcome for your homeless female veterans. First, allow me to give a brief history of my background. I am a retired United States Army veteran with over 22 years. I served with the New Orleans Recruiting Command as a recruiter, station commander, recruiter trainer, and guidance counselor for over 16 years, specializing in marketing and analysis. And I bring that up because you have to know your trends in the job market. Who's hiring? When are they hiring? When is the slow and fast season of their hiring? I've been with Goodwill Houston since August 2010 as an employment specialist, assisting female homeless veterans obtaining and retaining employment. With that in mind, our outreach strategies have a complex approach. I'm going to briefly give you examples and how we do it here in Houston, Texas. You must know your veteran, and that starts at the proper assessment. You must establish trust and credibility with your vets are so vital. Because of all the things that Ms. Reese had spoke about, your veterans are very suspicious. They're not comfortable with talking to people, talking to strangers, because you are a stranger until you develop that trust and credibility with them. They're very ashamed or maybe not even have a knowledge of what their benefits are. And so that proper assessment at the time that you speak with them, you must use that time to develop all of the resources that you need to assist them. And I mean by that is if they need to be referred for additional services, such as the vet clinics for counseling or the VA benefits, and when you're making that individual employment plan, make sure that that plan is designed for them, not for the employment specialist. And that document is a working document. It's subject to change as a veteran's need. We as employment specialists are here to guide and lead them, but not make that final decision. I want to discuss at this point two clients that I had, and I'm just going to call them TH and LW. TH was a veteran from the Navy that had completed 24 months in active duty Navy. However, when she got out, she was receiving 30% disability. She's having issues with housing, paying, you know, just keeping steady employment. And she applied for the HUD-VASH, which is a voucher for veterans. She was denied. Well, she wasn't denied. She just didn't feel comfortable. She thought that there was something suspicious about them paying for her housing because she was a vet. I instructed her to go back to the VA and reapply, bring all the documents that day, and she was notified at that point that she was not 30% disabled. She was 60% disabled, and they had owed her a year of pay. So veterans aren't aware of what their eligibility is. They're not aware of their benefits. They're not aware that if they need to go back and ask the right questions. The VA is not a friendly place, but they don't feel comfortable there, which means that they're going to be reaching for other resources, and that may be because of the way the system is structured. But because that employment specialist has to listen to all of those needs of that client, they have to ask open-ended fact-finding questions because you may have an answer and a solution for that client at that moment. Laura L. Williams was a client that came to us she had been out the military for over 30 years. She would try to attend her VA appointments, but she never could go in. And by her applying to our program and I'm assessing her, at that moment I realized that she had other issues that needed to be she needed to be referred to the vet clinics for counseling. And from that counseling, now she's able to work and keep employment. And during that assessment phase, we also need to find out what acquired skills do they have. And they all have some type of acquired skills, whether in the military or what they have learned in the civilian sector. And then determine those training needs that they need, whether it's through counseling, workshops, volunteering, local support systems or services. And if you, the provider, can't pay for it, find someone to pay to get that training that they need. Another issue in the assessment, you will have veteran clients that aren't eligible, that do not meet the requirement for the HUD-VASH. That requirement is 24 months. They must have served 24 months on active duty in order to get that HUD, in order to get that voucher. So what do those clients do? And that's where you have to be very creative and get out into your market, know your market, know the business owners, know who can help and assist you. With that in mind, I want to tell you a story about a young lady named Mandy that I had lunch with on yesterday. She is a business owner, has several apartments, and most of my clients, all of my clients are homeless, but most of them percentage of them, I should say, are actually living in their car. They don't want to go to the shelters because of their previous experience. This is not. This won't be their first trip there. So they're not very comfortable with that. Mandy owned apartment complexes, and she has agreed to house our ladies. She agreed to set up stage two apartments that are emergency shelters. One will be a unit with family, and one will be a unit that's single. And she will provide electricity because you can't get them work ready until they have their housing situation together. The next thing that I want to talk about is the different phases of knowing your market and finding those business owners that will hire our clients. The initial thing that we do here, we do cold calls, what I call cold calls. Those cold calls are ads in your local newspapers, the hiring papers, the internet, your local veteran employer flyers, and disabled veteran outreach specialists. Those places, those people that are always posting jobs and temporary staffing agencies. From those initial calls, we make those calls, we make the contacts that we need, and we, you know, tell them our story. From that, we go from the next phase where we're actually wanting to meet them face-to-face. We set up from that cold call, that cold contact, we want to meet them face-to-face, and we visit them, and we call them and label those business owners and hiring managers and recruiters as center of influences because they have the hiring power. We give them what we call here the FEBA. The facts is, you know, whatever your program is, the evidence that these are female veterans that are needing jobs and the benefit to that business owner for hiring a qualified skill set veteran. And the agreement to work with us, to work with our mission and goal of hiring a female veteran. After that, after we finish the face-to-face, we send them a thank you card. We may go to lunch with them, and we also provide refreshment in some form or fashion. Mandy, again, and I'm going to call this client, she's our housing partner. In this process of getting this housing partnership with Mandy, I had a client that was in the field of commercial and residential leasing. And this client is sleeping in her car. She has a skill set that matches Mandy's, you know, need, and she has an interview scheduled for Wednesday. So when you ask those questions and ask that face-to-face is so important because they can put a face to who's asking them about their business, and you're also meeting a need for them. We also have several different things here in Houston. One of them is called the Business Advisory Council. All of the members of that council are members of the Houston business community. We have developed a partnership on many levels with them. They help us with the employment, what we call the employment symposium. That's the business community volunteering their time for seminars, interview skills, dress code, and motivational speaking. Another outreach that we have is Lunch and Learn for our employment specialists and potential business for partnership. We have a Diva Exchange, and that Diva Exchange, because our women are homeless, they need clothing, we have local business vendors that will participate in that Diva Exchange, and with that, we are giving those ladies exposure and network and our program exposure. We have job fairs. We attend the job fairs because we want to get to know the hiring, those individuals that have the hiring power. The recruiters, we find out what jobs are hiring based upon the website, but then we want to put a face to the person that we're talking to when we're doing that cold call. We also thank them from the job fair. We get their business cards, and we thank them, you know, for talking to us. It was nice meeting you on this day. We discussed this, and I would love to get back with you. And we do proper follow-up. We also have a WOW meeting. At that WOW meeting, we are asking local business, female business owners or female motivational speakers to come and communicate to our clients, you know, the necessary thing, life skill classes. On Monday, we actually did a skin and face care for our clients, proper skin and face care. And the business owner that actually set that up, the salon and spa that set that up, is actually hiring for a receptionist. One of our clients applied for the position, and we'll know on Monday whether she's hired or not. So in saying that, we're asking anything that you do, you're trying to get your program exposure and your veterans exposure to what's available in the community. And with that, everything that we do, you have to look at the whole picture. And what I mean by that is you have family, friends, and small business owners that have vacant positions that need to be filled. And as she said before, as reset before, if you don't ask and ask for a referral and ask those business owners who are hiring, you could be looking over a potential employment for your clients. Talk to everyone. We talk to everyone. Everyone knows me as the veterans employment specialist in my church, in the grocery store, in the checkout, when you're making checkout. Just talk to, you know, I have business cards. I pass out business cards. I ask for referrals, and referrals are so important because you need to tell your story, tell your program story, and a lot of times jobs aren't even posted. It's by word of mouth. And always ask the business owner, do they know of another business owner that is hiring? In this area, we apply it to everything. Your female veterans that are working, those that have jobs, we ask them if we want the liaison that got the connection, we ask them, where are you working? And we pick up the phone and we call that manager or that supervisor, and we thank them for hiring our veterans. And if they have any, we tell our story, the facts, that, you know, what we do, the evidence, this is what we have, the benefit to you would be this. And then we ask for an agreement that if any positions come available and our clients meet those skill sets, that they would, you know, give us the opportunity, call us, and give us an opportunity to hire them first. I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to turn it back over to Mandy Bailey.
Thank you very much, Kathy. That was a very, very interesting discussion, and you both highlighted some really, really critical strategies to both reaching and placing homeless female veterans. So thank you both. And I think at this point we can go ahead and open it up to questions and comments. We have a lot of great experience out of everyone who has registered for the teleconference today. So if you have comments that you would like to share, if you have questions for either one of our speakers, we have a limited amount of Q&A time. So try and keep the questions as pithy as possible. And Jackie, if you want to go ahead and open up the Q&A. And once again, our speakers are Risa and Kathy, so go ahead.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Sarah Romeo.
Wow, I feel like I won the jackpot today. I hit the button fastest. Yes, I'm Sarah Romeo at Tampa Crossroads, and we have a HVRP for homeless female veterans and veterans with families, as well as a GPD transitional housing program for female veterans exclusively. So we've been working with this population for quite some time. We've been working in the general women's population for more than 3 decades. But one of the biggest barriers or issues I'm facing right now is we know that there is a severe lack of resources for women veterans with minor children. And we have been successful in being approved to develop a program here in Tampa for women and children veterans. We are a little, how can I say this gently? We're a little bit afraid to do that because even though the VA provides a very small daily rate for the women, there is no resource for the children. And I'm wondering if anyone else who is working in this population has found resources to assist the children of homeless families, because we know, again, from our years of experience, that the children coming in with the mom is also going to be trying to address some trauma issues just from the simple fact of being homeless. Many times they come from homes where there's a lot of domestic violence and a lot of issues. So has anyone that's working in this population now been able to find resources to assist those children that are being accompanied or by their parents?
Hi, that's such a poignant point, Sarah, and it is very frustrating. This is Risa, and one of the grantees where I've re-granted money for one of my projects in California, they're in the same situation. So they're doing employment. They're also doing a cognitive behavioral therapy intervention to help prevent domestic violence between veterans and those they care about. But at the same time, they're also running a transitional housing program for women. And like you, they're getting stipends that will deal with feeding and housing the women veterans, but not for feeding the children. So unfortunately, there really don't seem to be government resources that they can tap into, and the state of California budget is really being so negatively impacted, as is their county budget.
So is ours in Florida, yeah, same situation.
And I know it's really not unique to those two states, but it really is very tough. So they are truly finding that the best resources that they've been able to come up with have been through private and corporate donations. And they've been lucky enough to have a radio program broadcasting the good work that they're doing for these women veterans, but the lack of government funding for the children. And that's how they've been successful in raising some funds. I was successful in introducing them to my primary funder and having that funder send their, you know, corporate philanthropy program officers to come down and see the full range of programs. So, you know, I hate to say it, but the private foundations may be the best, or local people may be the best way to go. And being able to publicize the plight of these women and children and the poor organization, you know, because if you have a child of opposite sex that's older, or even, you know, just the number of children, you're sometimes wanting to put those children in another room, but that's a per diem bed, and it's
right.
you're in quite the conundrum. So that local radio program seem to have been a major differentiator for them in being able to get that story out. So I would say try to interest some local media and highlight the women, your program, offer to do site visits, let people in, you know, do fundraising deliberately for that, that really can, you know, showcase what you're trying to do.
I'm hoping that down the road, I mean, we have had some dramatic shifts in Washington for funding of veterans, specifically recently the prevention, homeless prevention projects, the BHPD. So there's somewhat of a thinking shift in Washington, and I'm kind of hoping that when you and I make these comments and talk about these barriers to assisting women with children, that that may move up the line at some point, because I think we are truly, truly victimizing and penalizing the women veterans by not assisting them to stay with their own children. I can't think of anything worse to do to anyone than to say, you can come but leave the kids behind. So I'm hoping that some of our comments and some of these discussions we're having nationally can move up the line so that they do know there is another issue here.
I can't agree with you more, and there's one quick resource that I would give people. I applied for and just was accepted as a community leader to come into briefing sessions at the White House, and Sarah, I will definitely make that point when I'm there, but others on the line might want to contact communityleaders@who.eop.gov for White House I don't know what the O stands for, I'm sorry, but you may wish to try and get on that listserv, and they're, you know, asking community people to come to the White House if you, like, list your availability several months from now. I mean, I've been trying for a long time. You, too, may be able to get in.
Great. That's great information. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Risa, for that feedback. And if other folks who are on the line who haven't had a chance to talk yet have had successes with any of those public-private partnerships, establishing additional care resources for dependent children, please give me a call or send me an email, and I can share that with the presenters. We can go ahead and take another call or another question.
Your next question comes from the line of Mary Mott.
Yes, hi. Mary Mott, Workforce Development Institute from New York State. We have contacted several female veterans. We had our first resource meeting and only six attended. Our dilemma is in the recruiting of additional participants in our area. Would you have any suggestions how I would go about doing that? I realize you gave us the outreach with the tear slips. Any other suggestions?
And Kathy has done some great outreach in Houston as well, so feel free to chime in there as well. Are you in a more rural or a more urban area? Where are you at?
Well, I'm in upstate New York, Syracuse,
okay.
Utica area. Yes, and I found my list of names from the Department of Labor. We partner with the Department of Labor, and we made contact with 60 female veterans, and only six responded.
Hmm.
And again,
I don't know what Kathy would say, but Mary, that's actually a good response rate.
Okay.
Let me see. Can I help you a little bit? And I've actually recruited out of that area, so I do know that. Try the recruiting stations,
mm-hmm.
the recruiting command, and the reserve centers.
Okay.
Because use your military community.
Okay.
Your VFWs, the agencies there. And see what
Thank
comes
you.
Out of that.
Right. We did work with the Vet Center.
Mm-hmm.
We really didn't get too many names, but the reserve station, that's a good idea, and the recruit station. I will try those two. Thank you very much for that.
And those reserve centers, let me tell you what you also need to ask for at the reserve centers.
Okay.
They have a inactive list also. Inactive reserve list.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, and every veteran knows a veteran.
Okay.
So you have a captured audience on their drill time.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever they do their drill time,
mm-hmm.
you can ask those unit administrators or the sergeant major of that command to let you come out and do a presentation about what it is that you're trying to do.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And from that, those veterans would give you referrals.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And Risa had also talked about in her presentation offering possible incentives to participants to
mm-hmm.
remain engaged. I'm not sure what your financial capacity is, but I've heard that from other organizations as well, that even limited incentives to show up at the site for that first time will give them that face-to-face interaction that's so important and may incite them to come back later. So that's another key element.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. We're a non-for-profit,
mm-hmm.
Grant-funded organization. So there is some funding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can go out and offer a small, as you said, don't use the word stipend, but I'll speak with the regional director. Kathy gave me a few suggestions, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
And $10 goes a long way.
Yeah, exactly. Just a little bit goes a long way. Go ahead and take another question.
Your next question comes from the line of Rebecca Bowman.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I guess my main question is how you were talking about how a lot of female veterans don't feel like they're engaged. You know, I'm a female veteran, and the other female veterans that I talk to, for a lot of people, it's like a generational thing. Like when I go to the VA clinic, I'm there with, you know, I'm probably the only female there. And I'm there with people who are, you know, a good 30 years older than me. You know, and so that kind of just makes you not feel comfortable, you know, from the get-go. So it's like you go and you have good intentions of going and being involved, but you don't really feel like you fit in.
Yeah, and that goes back to what I think both of our speakers discussed in different capacities, the importance of being conscious of different generations of veterans, you know, being understanding that sometimes using text messaging is going to be the best way to keep up with someone and make sure that they're staying engaged, and having that consciousness of different mediums that people are using to find your resources and to access information about your program.
And I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm with Volunteers of America, and we're an HVRP in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
And so our job is to get veterans back to work. And annually we enroll about 300 people. But every year for the past 5 years that I've been here, we've never exceeded 7 or 8 women.
Mm-hmm.
But I know for a fact that there's more than 7 or 8 women out there. There has to be. But I think it's the same thing. They come here and they see mostly males, and maybe they don't feel comfortable. They don't feel like they fit in. On a side note, we have in the past tried to do like a women's only side, and
right.
It was kind of like one of the other speakers said, you know, we promoted it, we advertised it, but the attendance was very low.
Mm-hmm.
And we even gave incentive gifts to show up. You know, and so it's just very hard, and it's very frustrating to get the female veteran to engage.
Right.
And I don't know if it's a pride thing, or maybe they just want to forget their service, or, you know, it's so hard to explain, you know, understand.
It's hard to understand because it's a multidimensional issue a lot of times. You know, many of them are dealing with sexual trauma and a host of other issues. It could be because they're not self-identifying as veterans.
Well, and that was the other thing that I was going to say. It seems like with men, they will, you know, they wear that veteran status on their sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with me, people can know me for months before it ever comes out that I was in the military, just for whatever reason. You know, even though I was in there for a while, but it's not at the top of my list.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe that's what it is maybe women get out and they don't wear that veteran status on their sleeve and they just want to forget about it, you know, and so but then they end up homeless and they end up lost in the cracks, but there are programs for veterans that are out there that could help them, but then they just don't want to identify as veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe it probably brings back some things they don't want to think about.
Well, Rebecca, I think your personal experiences do show a lot about, you know, other women veterans, too. One of the suggestions that I have for people, or even in Mary's revelation, that 10% of the people invited actually showed, that actually isn't a bad outcome. So if you rescale your expectations and you focus on really, you know, understanding, you're going to put a lot of effort into the outreach. But if you put a lot of emphasis on what would it take to retain the women once you get any of them in, so whether
mm-hmm.
it's 7 to 8 a year that you've experienced in your time of doing this in Knoxville, or for Mary, you know, she got those 6 in the door, working maybe more aggressively in slightly different ways than what you would do in your general program. And Rebecca, to your point, you know, that you know how it makes you feel when you walk into the VA and it's very male-dominated or older. You know, maybe trying to have some of your particularly first encounters not on site, you know, taking a page from what Kathy did with, you know, having like a spa day as the first experience, you know, in a different setting, making sure your staffing for it is more women vets like yourself, so there's that peer-to-peer component. Those are all things that might go a long way to, you know, maybe your programs for women will attract fewer numbers of participants coming in, but perhaps your goal should be to have a higher retention than accomplish on the other side.
Thank you.
Rebecca, this is Kathy. I would like to say also that what I have found, when those veterans come in, when those females come in, they have a barrier up already. So they have been through so many programs that they just think this is another program. I'm a number.
Exactly.
So that's why that trust and credibility has got to be there during that assessment phase when you first make contact with them. That trust, you have got to, from that very point, you have to establish trust and credibility. And what I mean by that is sometimes you may have to be transparent, just as you were saying, this is how I feel. Well, that's what I do. I'm a veteran. I have to go to the VA, and I'm very transparent. In my office, I have pictures of my son who is military. I have pictures of my husband who is military. I have pictures of myself who is military. And we talk on a personal level, always professional, but also on a personal level where I can relate to her because I have to go to the VA too. My son has to go to the VA too. My husband is a veteran. So I can relate because I'm transparent. And that's where the trust comes in at. The ladies that I have, if I tell them I want them somewhere, they're there.
Well, you just said something that really resonated with me because this is something that happens in the military world that does not happen in the civilian world. You know, you refer to your ladies as ladies,
mm-hmm.
is what you should refer to them as. You know, whereas when you're in the military, you're referred to as a female. A female this, a female that.
Right.
Well, be a cattle.
Right.
I mean, to me, that is derogatory.
Absolutely.
But I catch myself doing it because I do it, because it is so ingrained in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the other issue that I have is, you know, we call it military sexual trauma. In the civilian world, it's called rape. You know, military sexual trauma is kind of like a sugar-coating word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of how like shell shock was for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's almost like we're not validating what really happened to these ladies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know. I think that's why women are turned off about it. You know, and I mean, this is a very personal thing. It's not, you know, it's not a secret. A lot of people in my office, Everyone in my office is aware of this, and we're all women, so it's not a secret. But I'm, you know, a victim, survivor, whatever, of military sexual trauma. And during my rating, disability rating for it, it was a man who interviewed me, and he asked how had it affected my sex life. And I said that at the time it had affected my sex life. But I had also, after being married for 10 years, just given birth. And he made the comment, apparently it did not affect your sex life because you had a baby. And I was just like, oh, did I really just hear this? You know? And so I could see how these, if enough negative experiences that the women get turned off. And then they're just out there flapping in the wind.
But you can make the difference, Rebecca.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a sad situation for these women. Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult, and thank you for sharing that personal story. And, you know, it is difficult when people have positive and negative experiences, and that's why the VA has made the effort to have the women veteran program coordinators
mm-hmm.
at each one of the medical sites, which has been really useful. This is Bailey with NCHV. We actually answer a 1-800 line for veterans in crisis. And often when I do get women veterans, I'll make sure that they're hooked in with the VA for their benefits and that they do have the phone number and the contact information for that women veteran program coordinator, so that way they can, you know, they can have that direct person for outreach if they do feel comfortable.
Yeah, and I do, and, you know, on a positive note, and, you know, I've been out since the end of 2003. The VA is slowly catching up with the modern world.
And I hate to cut you off, but we've actually run way over, so I'm going to have to go ahead and cut you off here, but we can always continue this conversation later, too. I think everyone has our contact information And just again, I want to say thank you very much to both of the speakers today, to both Risa and Kathy for your time and for sharing with us your experiences and the research that you've done. It's been very helpful, and I look forward to hearing more from the participants on today's call, so feel free to contact me after the call if you have additional questions and comments. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.